Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you, and if you'd like to join us anytime during the hour, call us at 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to use, or from the neighbor islands or anywhere else if you're listening to the live stream, it's 877-941-3689. Most of us learned some lessons over the last 5 years. The Great Recession also became the great leveler for many. Young people and those near retirement got hammered in their financial lives, and families rearranged themselves. The difference, of course, is while young people still have a lifetime to earn, those near retirement have little, if any, time to earn back what they lost. And that's just why grays may become the next boomerang generation. In Hawaii, with our high rate of multi-generational homes, that could include at your house. Now consider this. Divorce in people over age 45 is growing. According to the 2011 Census Bureau's American Community Survey, about 18% are divorced or separated. Add in those widowed, and that's a little over 30% of Americans no longer with their partners. Now add those never married, and we're up to about 55% of Americans over age 45 on their own. So even if you're not yet near 40, these numbers may mean you could wind up alone in your later years and also caring for a family member. All of this may impact both your financial and healthcare future. This week, AARP President Rob Romasko is in town to talk about the impact of proposed changes in Social Security and healthcare on businesses, the group's constituents, and all the family members attached to them, which is to say, quite possibly you. Rob Romasko, welcome to Town Square.
Beth Ann, it's great to be here. Thank you for
And also joining us is AARP Hawaii State Director Barbara Kim Stanton. Thank you for being here.
Love being here. Thank you, Beth Ann.
We've talked about many aspects of what it means to live in Hawaii, and the multi-generational one is a biggie for us because we have the highest population of or the percentage of people who live in multi-generational homes, and yet this is still a tough one for, in some cases, younger generations to get their minds around, that when we talk about Social Security, when we talk about health care issues that might, at the outset or at least first blush, affect older Americans, it really affects younger ones too. And then you add to that the fact that some of the conversation in Washington is so divisive that it's really pitting people who are under 50 against those who are over 50. How do we begin to sort of disentangle these issues and really create a cohesive conversation about them?
Well, I think the first issue we have to think about is those who seek to divide us are really trying to hold on to power. Those who bring us together are actually more conducive to what the society is about. Let's just take Social Security, which is sort of a hallmark program that's been in place for over 70 years. And most people think, oh, that's for retired older people. Well, no, it's not. Social Security is a family insurance program. And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, it turns out that one-third of the recipients of Social Security are children, are widows, and are disabled. Basically, Social Security is our common agreement that will insure people's income. Income while you're working, if you're basically disabled. If the wage earner in your family or one of the wage earners basically dies in a premature sense, Social Security benefits support the family. And obviously, if you retire, you have the opportunity to collect Social Security as early as 62 or as late as 70. But when you look at that basic program, it's about families. It's protecting families. It's not just protecting an individual. Because frankly, as you so well point out, when we age, we're going to be dependent on, we want to be independent and people want to live in their homes and want to continue to be vibrant. But as we always are leaning on the community that we're in, and the community first is family and foremost. So if for some reason Social Security benefits are cut, which is one of the proposals that we see in Washington, the burden will the need doesn't go away. And usually that'll fall on a family member. So most people have to realize that all these programs are designed to help individuals, but those individuals are part of a family, and that family usually rallies around the individual, and the impact tumbles backwards or forwards or sideways. So Social Security is a great example of a program that's been labeled as a retirement program, but it's really a family insurance program for every generation.
And that's the part where a lot of people sometimes don't necessarily understand the fullness of that. And we're going to talk more about some of the permutations of it. But in general, in looking at Social Security, there's also the knee-jerk reaction to say that it's, you know, the pool of money. And that's another myth that we've had other conversations about to debunk a little bit, that this is not just a pool of money that can be used to defray the deficit. It's not even part of it or shouldn't be part of the budget.
Well, and we have a very strong opinion about that. We basically argue that the Social Security challenge, and there is one, because the way it stacks up right now, Social Security will pay full benefits for the next 20 years. If we do nothing, that benefit check will still go out in 2033, but it'll be smaller by a quarter. That's not acceptable because, frankly, most people who we represent are not only concerned about themselves, but they're very concerned about their children and their grandchildren. They want those benefits there. The second thing is they've paid in these benefits their whole lives, and they expect that contract, that promise, to be kept. But so what we want to look at is Social Security was part of a 20th century retirement program. What's the 21st century retirement program? Let's look at the assumptions that were made when Social Security was instituted. Social Security was supposed to be a minimum floor, guaranteed income, and eventually adjusted for inflation. On top of that, you'd have your pension, and the third leg of that three-legged stool was personal savings. Well, let's reexamine those assumptions. Well, pensions, whoops. this morning I was in a room full of seniors and asked, how many of you had pensions? Everybody's hand up went up in the room. How many of your children have pensions? Nobody's hand went up. There are no pensions anymore. It's defined contributions, which really relies on the stock market. So that leg is either gone or substantially frayed. The third leg is your personal responsibility, your ability to personally save and supplement, for retirement. What is the data telling us? If we look at folks over 45 who are about 20 years away from retirement, half of Americans have $10,000 or less saved.
That's a stunning figure. Even after we've come through, 4 or 5 years of recession, where there was a little uptick in the savings rate, but then even as recently as today, we've heard that the rate of indebtedness has now increased largely because of student debt,
right,
when people trying to retool their lives so they can be employed longer.
That's correct. And the second half of that conversation is, the other half have about $100,000 saved. And that includes Warren Buffett, who makes up for a lot of those folks. And $100,000 over a 20 or 30-year retirement, that really adds about $5 or $10 a month. So that's really not a lot. So then you say, what really is happening there? People have not been able to save. Is it because they're irresponsible, or is it because wages have stagnated for the last median wages in real terms have actually stagnated? So we have a real challenge in looking at retirement. We want a retirement conversation that really looks at this, looks at all aspects of it, our ability to work, our ability to save, and what role should Social Security play? We would say Social Security is going to play an even more important role. Already, Social Security is all about one out of every four recipients has. That's all they have. And that's about a $15,000 annual benefit.
And in Hawaii, I'm sure, Barbara, you've got the statistics right there, that in Hawaii that doesn't go very far, as well we know.
Oh, no. Social Security is what keeps the middle-income older Hawaii residents from falling into poverty. In fact, the census data shows that about 8% or about almost 16,000 people of older Hawaii residents are living in poverty. And without Social Security, we're looking at an additional 25% of older Hawaii residents, or about 49,200 people, would fall into poverty. And so when Rob talks about 2033 and Social Security being decreased by about 25%, if you're already in poverty or you're on the brink of going into poverty, that's a very significant amount.
And for anybody younger, that could be your parents, or that could be your grandparents or your great-grandparents.
That's right.
Which case that this is going to roll back into the family. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking with AARP National President Rob Romasko and AARP Hawaii Director Barbara Kim Stanton, and you. And our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about why this needs to be a generational conversation, not segregating older people, seniors who are above 65, those who are 50 to 65. We always want to look at these various different age groups. And yes, there are certain things that may be inherent to an age group that maybe won't be in another one. But the whole issue of threading through this is what we will do as we all continue to age, and we have to help those who are in our families also aging and needing to be with us. What do families do? We want to hear from you. 941-3689, 941-3689 from Oahu. And if you're listening to the live stream or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Are you even thinking about how this may impact you and your family if Social Security benefits change? And are you saving to compensate in any way? Have you changed your habits? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I mean, those are some very scary statistics that we've seen for quite a while since you did a survey and the, you know, having your say, and a lot of people who did. But it doesn't seem as if it's changing a lot of younger minds about this. Do we need to target younger people a little differently in this conversation, Rob?
Well, one of the things we're doing, in fact, I've added an element as I travel around the country. I'm now adding college campuses to my my schedule, and it's a very different conversation. Inquiring minds want to know. Curiously, when you ask the question about Social Security, two things come out, especially for the younger generation. Uniformly, they agree that these programs are important. So their attitudes about the importance of these programs almost equals the same as folks who are 50, 60, and older.
But does the concern for grandma and grandpa translate into how they will change their own behavior?
Well, but the first issue is that actually, why would these people have that understanding of how important these programs are? Because they see it in their own lives. They see what it means to their family, their relatives, and so forth. The concern that they have is, will it be there for me when I grow older? And everybody says, well, younger people don't think it'll be there. Well, when you go back to 1970, those people who were 20 years old then had exactly the same fear and doubt. So one of the things we have to do is make sure they understand that this program has been there for 70 years. It'll always be there. The issue is, how strong will it be, how adequate will it be, and how well will it be funded? And when people understand how important it is, and then you give them some choices about what would you rather do. Would you rather maintain the benefits? Would you cut the benefits? And how are you willing to pay for it? You get very interesting responses. Because, again, it's all fundamentally driven by the recognition of the importance, the centrality in families, how important it is, and from two sides. When we talk to folks that receive Social Security, they always talk about, I don't want to be a burden to my children. That is a universally felt feeling. And, you know, there's a great TV commercial, right, where you see father and son, husband and wife, having dinner, and they start arguing over the check. And the senior guy says, have we reached that point where, you know, is he saving enough for retirement? And the young man looks at his dad and says, has he saved enough for retirement? So both people start to look at that problem differently, but it's really the same issue, caring about the people we care about, not only our parents, but ourselves and our families. So I think that's kind of the way to think about it.
And when you're talking to college folks,
right,
are they buying into that part of the equation, too, that they need to also be personally responsible as much as they want to see Social Security be there and believe that, they'd really like to have it there, but maybe it won't be there? The same fears that you talked about that, you know, same age group of people had in 1970. But has that conversation changed at all in that 40-year period?
Well, it really hasn't, because I think, you know, if we all remember what it was like when you were 20 or 25, you're focused on getting a job, getting started, getting going, right, establishing yourself. That's become challenging for many people. College graduates and had a real tough time in the last 3 or 4 years. People under 30 have been struggling. But that doesn't stop them from hustling and working and trying to find and navigate their way. So that's kind of the normal thing. But they absolutely open up when you give them the facts, right? And one of the things that once they see that, then they understand how the programs are constructed, who they benefit, and how it relates to their family. But they have to have that information so they can sort of make that judgment. The savings rate has been going up. I think one of the challenges for younger people is obviously the enormous cost of education, the student loan debt, you know, which is now outstripped credit card debt. That's a significant and serious problem.
Which, again, we found out a little bit more about this morning.
And the other curious thing is, because of the economic challenge that many of us have confronted, senior debt is actually going up. folks over 55 have seen their credit card debt actually grow. And that's because they're either raiding their 401k plans or using their credit card to finance either healthcare issues or bridge them during an unemployment thing, or as we've seen, the number of people moving home to save some money to get started has increased dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years.
And also seniors realizing that they're going to have to retool their lives, go back to school, and develop a skill that they can market and stay in the workforce. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us tonight and you are under 35, do you think much about Social Security for yourself? We want to hear from you too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Not to make this a generationally dividing conversation, but one to bring everybody into some of the issues that are hitting all sides of the argument, why we need to look at retooling Social Security, how do we do it, how do we protect it, all the questions that have meaning for you may know, no matter how old you may be, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. I especially want to hear from you if you are under 30 and maybe just getting into the workforce, if you've been lucky enough to find a job. What do you think of Social Security? Is it just that deduction that you see and gulp over when you get your check? Or does it have real meaning for you as you look at your life and look into your family? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. It's kind of tough to hear the fact that we are supposedly in recovery, are recovering. I mean, all these things that we hear about numerically and statistically. And then to talk to real people who say, yeah, but I still can't get a job. And that person may be 50, that person may be 25, debt rising for both, whether it's for going back to school or to simply bridge the gap or because that's the only way they can survive. Mm-hmm. Debt increasing in so many ways. It seems that that's also becoming still the great leveler, as we talked about in the very beginning of the show, that had great effect on people when the recession started. Is this causing people to be able to be a little bit more compassionate with each other in having the conversations about issues like Social Security? When you talk to kids on college campuses, do they get that part?
I think it's more action and then what did I do? When confronted with these things, one of the great, I think great pieces about our society is people are terribly resilient. You know, people have taken a real serious blow in the last 5 years, and the vast majority of them have figured out, dusted themselves off, and figured out how am I going to do this? How am I going to cope?
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's a tribute to their resilience. You know that means if I have to get 2 part-time jobs to make things work, that's what I'll do because I need to do that for my family. Or if I have to move home with mom and dad, that's what I'm going to do because that makes financial sense, so I get on my feet. Or if I have to bring my kids back to help them, that's what I'm going to do. So people are resilient. They'll do what they need to do in order to bring the income in, to help their family survive, and to support each other. That's that intergenerational solidarity I talked about. And no, people don't, read a book at a library. They just sort of navigate day to day, week to week, hour to hour, and figure out how am I going to put this together in order for my family, the people I love, and to meet my responsibilities to that. So in that sense, when you step back, you see what they're doing. They don't get up in the morning and put the big plan on the blackboard. They basically take it day to day. You know, one of the ways I think about things right now is, we've had a recovery in a broad sense. And the old saying, it's a recession if your neighbor loses your job. It's a depression if you lose your job. And that's kind of the way it happens. About 20% of us are doing okay. 1% of us are doing really okay.
Right. And
80% of us are just trying to get to Friday.
And that includes 80% of us of all ages.
Right.
And that's the issue, that this is not simply just a matter of trying to pick out a particular group.
Right.
But yet that, going back to a little bit of what we alluded to earlier in the conversation, that's what's happening in Washington. And that type of divisive conversation is not necessarily helping the cause that you just talked about.
Well, and I think what we've talked about is there's a very serious conversation about the fiscal deficits and the challenge and the debt, and there's a real issue there.
And the fact that we have more sequestration cuts yet to come in 2014, the minute we hit January 1st.
Right. But the issue is let's not confuse that conversation with the real needs of real people. the budget conversation is not a math exercise. When you cut programs that are basically holding families together, societies together, communities together, you're not just solving a budget equation. You're talking about the very fabric of communities, the very fabric of families. So one of the things we talk about at Social Security is get it out of the deficit discussion. Let's have a separate conversation. Let's look at retirement. Let's look at savings. And let's look at the role Social Security will play, not only today, but for tomorrow. And one of our concerns is when we do that, you look at that three-legged stool, you come to a different conclusion that say, let's just cut benefits and save a little money and shore up the budget. Wrong answer.
Yeah. Well, Rob, I want to talk to you a little bit specifically about that because we're going to take some phone calls now. But in a moment, I will also want to go back to the whole issue of how that conversation about cutting benefits is one that we've been having regarding Social Security and trying to keep it out of the budget because it has been external to the budget forever.
It's the only federal program that has its own funding source.
But that still doesn't seem to trickle down into everybody's mind. It's almost looking like for the quick fix of the pool of money that you can use as your own personal piggy bank.
Well, you know, I've traveled across the country. We've had our Earn to Save initiative for over a year. The people who paid into the program, the people who are affected by the program, they understand it. It's the politicians in Washington that don't.
All right, well, let's see what some of our callers have to say. Going now to Sean, calling us from Wahiwa. Sean, thank you for your patience. Welcome to Town Square.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, basically, you know, the reason why I called in is you asked for people that are under age of 35 or 30. And my perspective on Social Security is while the premise of Social Security, you know, it was not established for what it serves today, I believe that it is a good program. However, me, as somebody that's under the age of 30, I don't want to rely on the government for my future. I want to make sure that I set myself up now so that I'm not a burden for my kids down the road, that I prepare and I plan. And I believe that that should be everybody's mentality because, you know, clearly the government is not, they don't always make the right decisions, regardless of what political party one person sides with. I believe that we should take it upon ourselves to plan for those that can plan. And then those that are not able to, that legitimately have reasons to seek those venues of government support, I believe that it should be in place for them, but the circumstances have to, you know, fall apart.
Sean, forgive me for having to interrupt you, but your line is really noisy and we're having a tough time hearing you, but I think we've got the spirit of what you had to say. Thanks very much for the call. You know, what he's talking about with being personally responsible, you can't argue with that, but he's also echoing some of the same sentiments of what you heard from college students as you've made your way around and what you say college students were saying in 1970, that, you know, we're not going to depend on the government. The government's not going to be there, but yet not wanting to have that necessarily go away.
Well, I think the next part of the conversation is personal responsibility is a bedrock principle. And, you know, think about Social Security is not a benefit. It's social insurance. Insurance means everybody pays in because we want to protect everybody. Now, this gentleman I'm so thrilled that he's going to save a lot. You know, he's not going to depend on the government. He's not going to be that one in four that depends on Social Security for all his retirement income. But if he's has a family and something untoward happens to him, and that income stream, frankly, is gone at the age of 35, like it was when my dad went to work and didn't come home one night, what will happen to his family? Will he have saved enough by the age of 35 to take care of them for the next 50 years? Probably not. So that's what Social Security is. It's social. It's income insurance for everybody, whether you retire or whether you're working
Barbara?
And being responsible.
Sorry, Barbara.
That's right. You know, that's one of the things we want to get out there. This is why we have to talk to the kids on college campuses or the young workers, because when you meet young people, we call them the young invincibles. They don't think anything's going to happen to them. And what happens is life happens. You just never know what's going to happen. And Social Security is a safety net. It doesn't matter on age because we in Hawaii, we have 22,686 people on Social Security because of disability. We have 15,525 children. I mean, this has nothing to do with age. We're talking about circumstances where something happens to the breadwinner and Social Security provides that safety net. Now, Social Security does not provide enough money to cover all costs, but it offsets for most people. But it is not just for the older senior, by no means. That's what we want to get across.
Sorry, the fact that this is a floor.
It's
not
a floor.
Meant to be something that covers all of your costs. So knowing what it is and what it's not, it's going to be a combination of a lot of things because, as you mentioned earlier, Rob, gone are the days where there's a pension. Gone are the days where there have been, you know, this ethic that one must save. You know, the ethos for most families is, I'll worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself.
And I want to applaud the gentleman that called because he's going to, you know, my guess is he's probably saving 15% or 20% of his paycheck every week.
Well, and
he'd be the only person I've met that's been able to do that.
To do it. Right. I mean, that's the point. We're not trying to sit here and be kind of pompous and looking at people and wagging fingers from on high because there are people who are working week to week, day to day, as you say, just trying to get to Friday, but also making it a priority to save and to ask yourself, really, do you need to have this thing? Or is that just sort of a nice to have, not a must have? And what's really important and de-emphasizing the stuff part of your life in some cases, particularly if you're talking to people who are under 30 and consumerism is so rampant with everybody, not trying to single them out. Millennials, yeah, we like you too. Don't worry about it. Not trying to point fingers. But with Sean, if he is lucky enough to be able to do that.
And hardworking enough and disciplined enough. That's all stuff we
That
applaud.
All wraps into the whole right, thing. That right. It's not just, okay, I'm going to be a good person and take 15 or 20%.
Whatever that number is.
I mean, it used to be 10%. Then it went up to 12%. I mean, now we're told that just for a couple age 65 and up, if you're 65 and up today as a couple, you're going to have $225,000 just set aside for health care. Just for health care.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty daunting for a lot of people and daunting for someone who's under 30 to hear. We've got some more folks on the line. If you'd like to be next, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands or if you're someplace else listening to the live stream, get to us at 877-941-3689. Zoran calling us from Maui. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Mahalo. I just had a question. Would you agree that maybe it's the government would actually have some responsibility on the impact on how us younger generations can save as to opposed to just being solely on us? I mean, tax prices, per se, especially here in Hawaii, as you know, the cost of renting is so high, especially here on Maui. And maybe being able to give that kind of a break for people that do rent and not have that privilege to own a place. That we need a place to live. So having that kind of a way to save by maybe cheaper way of living here.
And that way that doesn't include living with your parents?
Exactly. Not living with your parents. Because maybe some of us have moved here from different parts of the world, different parts of the country. Whatever our reasons for being here.
All right, Zoran, let's get an answer for you, and thanks very much for the call. Now, on the face of this, Rob, you know, it might be, well, you know, are we looking at people who kind of want to have it in all ways and being able to have cake and eat it too? Does there need to be some measure of hardship in all this? Does that have to happen?
I think one of the things is we make choices, and one of the things we love about our country is we have as much freedom to make choices. Where we live, you want to live in Maui, that comes with some wonderful things and some other challenges.
So the tax breaks?
Well, you know, there's a whole separate conversation about tax reform. Our tax code has in it some people get tax breaks and some people think corporations are people and they get lots of tax breaks. So the whole tax code needs to think through both in simplicity, fairness, progressivity, and what is it we're really trying to encourage.
And what you're doing is making the point that none of these issues are happening in a vacuum.
That's right.
That they're all related to each other, but not necessarily going to give you extra bunts because you're younger and you know it's tough to live here. Presumably somebody has chosen to be here for whatever reason. You got to take it as it comes and then make your choices accordingly.
Well, that's part of it. But, I think it's a fair thing to say, what is it we're really trying to do? What are we trying to encourage, and how do we have adequate housing? How do we have good investment in education? How do we, I come from a business background. I'm going to put my factory in a place where there's an educated workforce, there's infrastructure that will get my products to market, you know, there's a rule of law that will protect me and courts. I'm going to be interested in that place.
And a place you can afford to
well,
be
and also and where the people that I hope to employ will be able to flourish, and I get really good workers who aren't worried about, living in shanties all the time. And that's kind of responsible corporate citizenship. And I think we have to take a look at the broad portfolio of activity, taxes included. But what we're trying to do is say, let's have a realistic conversation about retirement and how we save for it, how we provide for it, and how we protect people, at that minimum floor benefit of Social Security, which is, as I said, a family income insurance
program. Well, we've got lots of folks with families on the line now. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call now. We'll get you through as soon as we can. Going now to Alan calling us from Kauai. Aloha, Alan, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. I think that Social Security was created in the 30s, retirement age 65, life expectancy 67. Now that we're living so much longer, I know there is already a programmed increase in the full retirement age, but with people living into their mid to late 80s, don't you think there needs to be some recognition of that in reconfiguring Social Security? The other thing is, what's the justification for capping earned income levels above a certain level? You pay no more into Social Security. I could never figure that one out, but it seems to me it just benefits the ultra-rich. Finally, the thing that's going to take out all of my life savings potentially will be a catastrophic health care issue requiring massive costs. And unless we contain health care costs, nobody's going to be able to afford retirement.
All right, Alan, you've asked a lot of questions. I want to get you some answers here. We'll take the first one of raising eligibility to a higher age.
Well, first of all, we've already raised the age to 67. And if you look at all the Western countries, we have the highest retirement age for the quote-unquote full benefits. So we've already done that. Now the question is, do we want to do it more? Well, let's think about the impact of that. First of all, we talk about averages. Well, not everybody lives to 68. Not everybody will live to 80. It's very socioeconomic dependent. If you're a coal miner, your chances are your ability to continue working and go down that shaft when you're 67 is probably not high, number one. Number two, we don't have enough jobs for everybody to work to 68. So that's or 70 or whatever the age is. So we look across the spectrum of all of our citizens, and it's very uneven. The more wealthy you are, the more likely you're going to live a long time. The less wealthy you are, the more likely your lifespan is going to be limited, number one. Number two, we have a lot more things to do in terms of raising the age versus not and the impact that has. He raises the other issue, which is, there are income, there are revenue solutions here.
The earned income issue.
Right. Right now it's capped. I think in 2014, the first $117,000 of income, earned income, your wages, will be taxed. The next dollar is tax-free and as far as the eye can see. Well, let's look at the cap and how that works. In the 70s and 80s, it was designed to tax 90% of all wages. Now, even at $117,000, it only taxes 84% of all wages. What's happened? There's been income redistribution upward. There's been an explosion at the top, so more wages are not affected by that tax. When people talk about different solutions, they talk about a series of revenue solutions. One is to raise the cap so we go back to that 90% level. If we did that, that would solve about one-third of the shortfall we talk about 20 years from now. Others have suggested that we should basically uncap it and basically tax all wages all the way up, all the way up. That would solve the entire problem if we did that. But it's a tax. So we have a sort of aversion in this country to taxes, and that would be a challenge. But in terms of solving this, the solvency problem, if we just had that Social Security tax, 6.2% on my wages, 6.2% by my employer, and we just tax every dollar of wage income all the way to the top, that would solve the entire problem. If we went back to 90%, that solves about a third of the problem. If we change the rate from 6.2 to 7.2 gradually over 20 years, that would solve about 40 to 50% of the problem. So there's lots of different combinations we could work on the revenue side that would solve the solvency problem, maintain the benefit, and it's a question of what country kind of country do we want? What can we afford? And what are we willing to pay for?
And how you're willing to see that happen with your own taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Because to talk about it academically is one thing, but when you ask someone, how do you feel about having one more percentage point of your taxes, of your pay going to taxes, most people will look and say, I'm not so sure I want that. But it goes back to that fundamental question of what is it that you want to see in this country,
right?
And who needs to be protected, and other people who shouldn't necessarily be using that as an income at a certain level if someone is making $500,000.
And again, one of the aspects of social insurance, which Social Security is everybody's in. If we start excluding people because Warren Buffett, he doesn't need it, all of a sudden we've now created two classes of people, the people who pay into Social Security and need it and those who just don't need it.
And that knee-jerk reaction of saying, oh, well, we should be taxing the wealthy at a higher rate?
Well, I think the issue there is more an issue of there is progressivity in the Social Security tax, not the tax, but the benefit structure. So that even though you pay the same amount of tax for everybody, it's a flat tax on the first $117,000, your ratio of benefits to what you pay in is much narrower as you get wealthier. So the income replacement ratio for someone making $40,000 or $50,000 a year is much higher. He's much more likely to have his benefit replicate his earnings during the year. Warren Buffett's never going to get an income replacement ratio even approaching what his income is.
You know, I really loved Alan's question. And the reason I love it is because he's obviously thinking of different options. And one thing AARP has been doing is we've been going statewide to talk about ways to strengthen Social Security. And there's a number of options, and he named at least three. And I think that if people are thinking about what's the best way to strengthen it, I really encourage them to come to one of our sessions. You've earned a say. And if we don't have one in your community, go to aarp.org/earned a say, because all the options are out there. And the kinds of things that Rob, our national president, just talked about is, well, if you do this, here's the impact. So you see the different impact of different options. And so it broadens the conversation, and you get a sense of what people think will matter. How would they strengthen Social Security?
The second thing he mentioned, which was so insightful, is what he's really concerned about.
Catastrophic illness or healthcare costs.
And that's basically where Medicare comes in, right? Medicare is, again, a compact we've made with each other that says once we reach 65, we get a reasonable benefit, which covers about 60% of our medical costs when you kind of look across the spectrum. It's not a lavish program, but it does provide some minimum coverage so that, you know, as we age, that the core pieces of doctor visits and hospitalization and now prescription drugs can be covered by the Medicare benefit, which really is a huge issue and a huge protection as we age. The broader issue is Medicare is also a fiscal challenge, and we have to have a very thoughtful way of dealing with it. A lot of people want to cut benefits. Well, when you cut benefits, the need doesn't go away. You still have to go to the doctor. You still have to take your medicine all of a sudden.
And the costs are just going to be shifted someplace else.
So we don't want a cost shift. It's a legitimate thing, though, to say, can we make Medicare more efficient? Can we deliver quality care at a lower cost? The real focus is not so much on Medicare. Medicare is not driving the deficit. Healthcare costs are driving the deficit. One of the things that most people don't realize, grasp, is we spend $2.7 trillion on healthcare in this country. On a per capita basis, we are 50% more expensive than any other country in the world. And you say, well, we spend the most. We must have the best healthcare system. Well, we have the best doctors and the best dedicated nurses. But when you look at health outcomes, we're number 37. We are really beating Slovenia and Cuba. But that's about all we can say.
But there is a movement to drive it toward outcome and
right.
performance rather than just simply fee-for-service.
Right. And that's one of the significant developments in the Affordable Care Act. It's beginning to change the incentives. So we should use Medicare to encourage reform in the healthcare system broadly and at the same time look for responsible solutions to make Medicare more efficient while not cutting beneficiaries. Because, again, cost shifting doesn't help. All it does is move the cost from one person to another. And more importantly, the beneficiaries, if you think about it, beneficiaries are already paying probably somewhere between 15% and 20% of their incomes already including Medicare premiums and copays and so forth on medical costs, which, again, when in the average Medicare recipient, the income is about $20,000. So that doesn't leave a lot left over for the basics of food and utilities and shelter.
I promise we're going to go to callers in just a second, but I want to ask you, because this keeps the question that keeps floating around all the time is, isn't the healthcare system going to bankrupt us, especially with those who are aging and families who will need healthcare and catastrophic care and simply be able to have basic care going into the future?
Well, I think unbridled, if the pattern from the last 20 years, except for the last three, we're going to continue in healthcare inflation. We're running at 5% and 10% a year. That's a reasonable assumption if you just project that. The good news is, in the last 3 years, healthcare costs have moderated for the first time in over 50 years. We're not sure why that is. The specter of the Affordable Care Act has actually changed behavior in the healthcare community, where they're actually starting to look for efficiencies without cutting care. That's a very significant development. Others would say the recession caused people just not to get the care that they need because they can't afford it. And increasing evidence that I see is the healthcare community is starting to look at costs in a very different way, and not as an unbridled thing that they can't control, but way that they can deliver costs in a more efficient fashion. You mentioned earlier the idea that we're going to start paying for healthy outcomes, not just for transactions. Let's take hospital readmissions. That's a great example. The statistics tell us that if people leave the hospital, there's a 1 in 3 chance they'll get readmitted. Well, the reimbursement process is the hospital keeps getting paid for the readmission. That's like buying a new car, spending $40,000, driving it off the lot, it breaks down, you go back to the dealer and he charges another $40,000. You wouldn't accept that. You'd say, fix this thing now. And now there's a whole set of regimens that basically reward hospitals if they lower their readmission rates and penalize them if they don't get them down. That's a way of using incentives, for the right incentives, for good outcomes, quality outcomes at lower costs.
I made a promise we would take some calls. We're going to do that now. If you want to get in on the conversation, call us at 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, or from the neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. Going to Beth, calling us from Maui. Aloha, Beth. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, I'm actually in Mo'ili'ili.
I'm sorry. I have the wrong thing down here. Well, that's wherever right. You are, we're glad that you're joining us.
Thank you. And I think that Alan and Barbara, I can just tell that they're very caring and that they're really trying to help people. And it's very heartening to hear this conversation. I'm glad that people are talking about this. My concern is that in Hawaii, several years ago, the legislature passed a bill that said Hawaii state, city, and county employees that are part-time, temporary, seasonal, or casual are not part of the Social Security system. They don't have Social Security taxes taken out of their wages. On their W-2, it's a zero on Social Security wages. On Social Security tax paid box, it's a zero. They're not contributing. They're not in the system. If they become disabled on the job, they cannot collect if they have not contributed in the last 5 years.
Beth, hang on a second.
Yeah.
I hear you, but
the idea.
But I'm asking you very simply, is there a particular part of city and county that you've had some experience with?
Well, I work for the state at the university, and my Social Security statement has 7 years of zeros because I was a teacher at the University of Hawaii, and in those years I did not contribute to Social Security even though I was working full-time year-round.
Okay, but what about the city and county, because you sort of pointed a finger at them.
Same thing. They have the same stuff. So if you work as a temporary hire, they just hire you and they hire you for 10 weeks or less, and then they don't contribute to Social Security. A lot of people are not aware of this. And then after your term is up, they just rehire you again so they can keep you on a temporary contract.
Which means for them, they don't have to outlay the money for benefits either.
Right. It's a way that the state saves money. It was a big boon in their legislature when they passed it, so they could save money by not paying tax, Social Security taxes on these people. And guess what? A lot of these people are women.
So your point,
a lot of them are in low-paid jobs.
And your point is that we're going to end up paying for this anyway, and all it was shifting it a little bit further into the future. Beth, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you. And I'm wondering if AARP Hawaii is doing anything about this.
Well, we're going to ask them right now. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Barbara, when you hear her say things like she has 7 years of zeros and not having paid into it because she was a temporary hire all over those 7 years, many more, you know, city and county lifeguards, other people who have told us similar stories like this. What do we do to get them into the system? Because it seems like it's simply just pushing it further into the future where someone could say, well, hey, it didn't happen on my watch, but it saved us money now. Is it sort of the penny wise and pound foolish?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I hear stories like this, and this is really short-term thinking. You're thinking you're going to save the 6.2%. The employer is thinking they're going to save the 6.2% today, and not realizing that along the way, when the person retires, you're going to be paying even more. You really have to, you know, the as an employer, and I don't mean just the city and county or the state. She just happened to mention those. But employers really should be looking at how to treat the employees as the valued assets they are. And one of the things you do if you're a responsible employer is to make sure that the welfare and health of that employee is stabilized, is strengthened, is reinforced.
So Barbara, how do you answer, though, when for example, a couple of weeks ago, about a month or so ago, when we were looking at the launch of the Health Connector in Hawaii, and we had a chap call up and he said, you know, I care about my employees. I want to do the best by them, but I only have so many dollars. I don't know really how I'm going to make this happen. I mean, you could feel for the guy because he's trying to run a business and trying to do well by his employees at the same time. But the dollars, you know, simply don't multiply because someone is compassionate. And his point is, look, I can't afford to do all of this. What am I going to do? And state Insurance Commissioner Gornito was on the phone. He said, well, I hate to say this, but you may have to look at capping people's hours so that you don't have to do that, which seems to fall right back into the same situation that Beth just called to talk about.
This is just going to take a lot more community discussion and perhaps community mobilization. But, you know, to cap people's hours and what we're seeing a trend, not so much in Hawaii, but on the mainland for sure, is that to get away from any kind of responsibility to help people, they look at what's required. You know that we have the Prepaid Health Care Act in Hawaii where you're required to pay for health care if you have at least 20 hours of a week. And fortunately, we don't see a lot of employers just saying, okay, I'm going to work you to 19 hours or 19 and a half. I mean, that really, you don't see a lot of abuse in that. But at some point, you know, it's very worrisome. So the only thing I can tell this caller is that we need to raise the consciousness of it and start that discussion about fairness. I mean, perhaps she could be talking to some of the unions. I know she's probably not in a union. She's working part-time. But that's not a bad place to start because they faced this before.
Beth,
and also,
so
we would be happy to talk to them.
It may take a coalition.
But it's going to take community action because elected officials take action when the community rises up and say, no, this isn't right, or we have to have a different way of doing it. And that's the whole beauty of collective action and the consumer speaking as a group.
We tend to think that we are a very good and caring group in Hawaii and that we care deeply about issues like this. And yet, there's still the pocketbook. It's not an easy fix by any means. But the bottom line question is really, what kind of Hawaii do we really want to see in 5 years, 10 years, when we're going to have a whole bunch more people who are going to fall into the now senior category and they're going to be needing to draw on the system?
Well, we're the fastest growing senior population in the country. And when we were, you know, the thing that resonates with us when we're going from county to county is, and especially in the neighbor islands, everybody's worried. They're saying, can I afford to retire in Hawaii? That is the big question of the day.
Yeah, even if they've lived here their whole lives.
Their whole lives, and especially if you've lived here your whole life. And you want to stay in the community that you're familiar with, your family's here, you have friends, you have your activities. And people are afraid they're going to be squeezed out because of the lack of financing.
Well, we don't want to squeeze out some of our callers, so let me bring them into the conversation. JK calling us from Haʻiku. Thanks very much for your patience.
Aloha.
Hi there.
Hi. You're doing a really nice job. I'm covering a lot of variety of subjects on this issue and bringing you back to where you started divide and conquer between the 50-year-olds and less, you know. Long-time strong-arm tactic of any union.
Did you have a question?
Well, no, I'm just commenting that you're bringing up some really nice issues.
Well, good. Thank you for enjoying the show, and thanks for listening. Going now to Donna calling us from the Big Island. Donna, welcome to Town Square.
Hello. I'm so glad that they brought up the fact of unions, because if you will look at some of the politics that have been going on to undermine unions, when I worked for the union, I had 40% taken out of my paycheck, but that was also met by my employer. So I have what I consider a very comfortable retirement. I am now 81, and I want you to look at the politicians who seem to be against unions, and they are all about, we're protecting business. That's point number one. The second one is, if you have good health care, maybe not so many people would not live to an age where they don't have to have their children and their wife rely on Social Security. And as far as I'm concerned, this new health care plan, it's not going to bankrupt anything. All you have to do is look at Europe and Canada. They're not bankrupt, and they take much better medical care.
Well, true, but you're also
population.
Talking about a different...
I have one more.
Quickly.
Now, the gentleman who is has his business degree who's talking, what I'd like to know is what basic wage would he pay his employees so they in turn would put money, more money into Social Security? Do you think that the Walmart owners now need to have any more profit? Wouldn't it be just wonderful like they weren't?
Well, but Don, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, looking in people's pockets and telling them what they can and can't do, the idea of trying to create something that is a living wage and that someone can be able to save and earn, I mean, those kinds of the conversations and the part about, you know, the unions and the proper place for a union. Many of the unions are in that same discussion and trying to figure that part out for themselves, too. And at least good for you that you were able to have such a nice retirement and feel so comfortable. Some way, somebody got it right. Going now to Sean calling us from Honolulu. Sean, welcome to Town Square.
Hello, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, the question I had is, I was wondering if anybody had ever tried to calculate how much the concept of punitive damages sucks money out of the healthcare industry, because it looks to me like since punitive damages don't punish anybody because everybody has insurance to cover it, it's just a transfer of money out of the medical industry into the legal industry for the basically the value of all the premiums for malpractice insurance paid by every entity in the medical industry.
All right, Sean, I've got Rob nodding head here and wanting to answer you, so stay with us and we will get you an answer.
Well, he's speaking about something that AARP is basically saying, we ought to take a look at tort reform. The facts are, though, that the settlements, the actual settlements that say you'll get X dollars because Dr. Jones didn't practice properly, the actual dollars are actually going down. So the settlements are actually going down. What is of concern is, are people practicing defensive medicine, meaning ordering tests in excess to protect themselves from being sued? So tort reform needs to be looked at as a way not only of making sure the individual has proper recourse, but also to give the medical profession surety and predictability so they don't overtest and practice defensive medicine. And there are a lot of suggestions out there that would address that issue. Tort reform, the actual numbers of dollars paid out in settlements has actually been going down. Is it just a fraction of what the total cost is? It's something worth looking at, but it's not really the driver of high cost of medical costs.
So the argument that this is sort of being driven by CYA medicine is a little bit specious?
Well, no, I don't think it's specious. And people, it's very hard to quantify, but I think it's a legitimate thing to look at to provide the medical profession with certainty, and a swift a swift judgment in terms of whether or not this is a junk lawsuit or there's some validity to the individual's claim, and protect the individual's right to get recourse if the medical profession has not been responsible.
And the back-end discussion of that, too, is also what happens or what makes the situation a little bit better when records are more available and when doctors can already see what's been done.
Right.
And be able to create something cohesive, not here having just one doctor see somebody here and one doctor see
right.
somebody there.
Electronic medical records will go a long way to make sure we don't have redundant care that's not really helping you get healthy, but just sort of repeating the same test that you had three times in the last year.
So we're coming to the end of the hour. And for a lot of people who are listening to this and thinking, okay, well, it's now a whole big headache, more things that I have to talk about with my family. These conversations are not easy necessarily to have with your family, with yourself. But really, the bottom line of everything is you're really asking, particularly those who are in the younger generations, to pay attention to this. And the mere fact that you're going to college campuses, which maybe a couple years ago wouldn't be on your agenda,
mm-hmm.
speaks to the fact that somehow making a cohesive conversation is taking top space on your list of priorities.
Well, it's all about connections. It's all about intergenerational solidarity. It's all about the caring become the cared for. We're all in the journey of life and the arc of our lives. And to really think about how we want to live our lives, how we want to be part of the family, how we want to care for those we care about, and how they want to care about us. And I think by having that discussion and looking at the options and putting the facts on the table, the American people tend to be terribly resilient and usually make the right decisions.
And facts that you think that in Hawaii are particularly relevant that those who are under 35 or 30 should really be paying attention to right now.
Absolutely, and because this is a wonderful state.
But which ones would you say, hey, look at this right now?
Well, I think the most important thing is what everyone's been preaching. You've heard this. You need to be saving. The miracle of compound interest is an amazing thing. If you saved an amount of money in your 20s and 30s, that has an enormous effect later on. If you postpone that saving until you're 50, that's going to give you a much smaller nest egg. That's on the personal responsibility side. And understand that you're part of a community, you're part of a social insurance system like Social Security, like Medicare, and those benefits that you pay in for now will redound to you later. That's something you're going to need, your family's going to need. We're all in this together. And we need to think about ourselves not only as individual responsible people, but as part of a community that we all want to prosper.
And truly understanding that some of that responsibility is going to be shifting to you to take care of people in your family. There's no, get home free card with any of this. You may get out of school, you may find a great job, but sooner or later, and maybe sooner than later, you're going to be taking care of people in your family or helping them to take care of themselves. But especially with those stats that we talked about earlier on in the hour, with how many people will be alone even after age 45, widowed, divorced, never married, and also living on Social Security. There's some confluence there where if you're under the age of 40 or so, you might want to put that into your plan
right.
as you move through your life. Robert Masco, thanks so much for being here. We're going to talk about one more thing before we go, though. Of course, all week on The Conversation, we've been talking about what's happened in the Philippines, and we would be remiss if we didn't also give you the opportunity very quickly to say that AARP has started a fund for those in the Philippines, matched dollar for dollar.
Right. AARP Foundation, which is our foundation, has basically said they'll put up $500,000 as a matching gift for any individual contribution. You just go to our website, aarp.org/disaster relief, and we'll match dollar for dollar every dollar of contribution for that. So your dollar will result in two, and that goes directly. 100% of that goes to organizations that are practiced at delivering aid to the people that need it in the Philippines.
Yes, Robert Masco, good questions.
And Barbara Kim Stanton, we got to say goodbye. We got 8 seconds, and we will see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Aloha.